You are listening to the Indefensive Plants podcast, a show designed to cure plant blindness around the globe. Support for Indefensive Plants comes from listener donations. If you would like to give your support to Indefensive Plants, please consider becoming a patron over at patreon.com/indefensiveplants. And together, we can help cure plant blindness one episode at a time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Indefensive Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefensiveplants.com. What's up? This is your host, Matt. Welcome to the show. How's everyone doing this week? Today's episode is part two of my conversation with Steve Bost about the plight of the Ozark chinkapin. If you're not familiar with this tree, make sure you're listening to part one of this conversation, which is last week's episode. It's a fascinating story of both ecological and cultural extinction, but a second chance at life for a tree that not many people know about. Steve is the founding president of the Ozark Chinkapin Foundation, and along with many other volunteers and colleagues, they are working hard at bringing this tree back from the brink. And I mean back from the brink of extinction. This is a tree that was almost lost, but as you can hear in the first episode and in the continuation of this one, there's hope, there's reason to celebrate, and there's reason to fight for what you believe in. And that, in this case, is saving a species from extinction. So, let's jump into it. Here is part two of my conversation with Steve Bost. I hope you enjoy.
So DNA studies that we're doing are showing, and blight studies are showing, that there's two sets of resistance that we're finding with Ozark chinkapins. And for the listeners that don't know, we actually, this is the partnership thing. There was only one place that I knew of that was able to do blight testing where you did not have to inoculate a tree. Mm-hmm. So the old recovery action plan that I had, the plan for testing these trees was to cross large surviving trees. So we'll take pollen from one tree, from a large one that may be, you know, a 12-inch, 18-inch tree, and we may drive a few hundred miles and cross it with another one. Well, the female flower is only viable for about 2.5 days. And so on the end branch of an Ozark chinkapin, you know, where I'd only find like one or two nuts, it was because there wasn't enough pollen. Hmm. So the trees that made pollen were so far between, you weren't getting much pollen. And so on a research test plot, so we have a lot more pollen, and we're starting to see some very interesting things going on with the tree that's never been recorded or documented before. So getting back to what I'm saying on the DNA studies, though, and then the blight study, the old plan that we had in the recovery action plan was, number one, find surviving trees, then try to find trees that survived the blight. So we've done that. We're up to 46 trees now. And National Geographic, when they did that article, we'd found 45. So just in the last few weeks here, we found another large surviving tree.
Excellent.
And it's 17.3 inches. Appreciate it. 17.3 inches DBH.
Wow.
And so we have a network of people that are looking for these trees. Most of them are on private property. And so we don't give that location. If it weren't for all these people that have stepped up, and, you know, it's a higher calling, you know, to do this. And it's something that, you know, without this network of people and volunteers working, doing what we're doing, none of this could happen. It's like I was rolling a ball and the ball kept getting bigger. Now I've got all these people on the board helping, and you're doing it too with this information on this podcast. And so information is absolutely powerful. You know, I don't try to convince people this is what we need to do. I just tell them what we found out and what we do. And some of them are inspired by it and want to do some, and some of them, you know, it may not be something they're interested in. That's okay. Mm-hmm. And so, but all the people that are on our board are doers, and they have real diverse backgrounds, but all of them have in common that they want to save this tree, and they can get things done. They've all got full-time jobs, but we all have the uncanny ability to get things done ahead of time. Hmm. And so going back to this, so the old recovery action plan was to actually, after we found these trees, cross them and then grow them on research test plots and have them hidden from view. You don't want to make them public places. Then after you get these, then take the best of the best that you've got when you cross these trees, and then plant them at another location, which there's no pollen contamination from the first one. allow them to freely interpollinate with each other. And then you check the offsprings of that, the F2s. And then with those F2s, you plant them at another place, which would be, we're talking 300 to 500 trees, and we're talking a lot of work here.
Yeah.
And so then after about 5 years, once these trees get to the point where that the blight will come on, then you inoculate them with two types of blight. And contrary to what a lot of people think, we have dozens and dozens of varieties of chestnut blight, Cryphonectria parasitica. In fact, I'm told by other experts that maybe over 100 in America.
Ooh.
So hypovirulence may not be the answer on it. Although we're finding out some interesting things with it. We've experimented with it. I got USDA approval a few years ago to actually do it, and we've used that as well. That's just another part of our recovery action plan. So where the water hits the wheel and the main emphasis is our breeding program. So going back to these trees, so let's imagine you've got 500 Ozark chinquapins that came from crosses of the best trees. Then you go in and you remove a place about the size of a silver dollar on them, and you inoculate that with the nastiest blight in North America. And then you pick out another place away from that spot and you inoculate it with the mildest blight in North America. And then you observe these 500 trees for the next, 5 years and see what happens. Some of them may die from the blight. Some may hang on. Some of them may have real high resistance to it. So the ones that you've determined after about 4 or 5 years of growth, but now these trees are like 9 or 10 years old, then that is the one that you focus on collecting nuts from and repeat the process. And that's what you're focusing on. Well, thanks to Missouri Botanical Gardens and their excellent lab and the support of people there, their staff, and Matthew Albritt and Leslie Bost, we've made some huge leaps forward in technology. And they're the only place I've found that can do what's called leaf assay, whereby instead of doing what I described to you, you actually take a leaf and inoculate it with the blight. And in 5 days, you can tell how resistant that tree is to the chestnut blight.
Wow.
And so this didn't happen by accident. There's one lab in New York at Sunny University, and they've partnered with us, and they're excellent. They were great enough to not charge us anything for this. And so we went out, and I sent a guy out there, and he actually, Colton Zirkle, he actually went out and actually learned how to do this process. And we didn't have much money, but the board approved it. This is so important. So we used part of our money for his airline ticket and to pay his room and board to go out there and learn this. And he video recorded it and came back. And so then my daughter really jumped on board on this and has been pursuing it and taking it to new levels. And so now what we're doing, we're actually inoculating the blight on a pure American chestnut leaf. And I'm giving a short version of what you do. The process has a lot of tweaks to it you have to do. There's a lot of steps you have to follow to make sure it's accurate. You have to have fresh leaves, and they can't come from the end of the branch. It's like the Goldilocks you got to get. Then, you have to have an autoclave to make sure you sterilize your work environment. And the lab up at Missouri Botanical Gardens in St. Louis is awesome. And they agreed to let us use their lab to do these cutting-edge blight tests.
Nice.
And so with them, we found out some interesting things. So in them, you will inoculate a leaf of a pure American chestnut, which we've had to grow these, and we've had great help getting the seed for this, which is kind of hard to find these days. Then we had Ozark chinquapins, that we've tested, some that are susceptible to blight, and then some that from our big trees that we found, and then some from our crosses that we did. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you take a leaf from a Chinese chestnut, Castanea mellissima, and then you inoculate all three of these leaves. So doing the test, we found, just like the DNA was showing, you see that the blight spreads the fastest in the American chestnut leaf and not quite as fast in the Ozark chinquapin leaf, and it shows even less spread in the Chinese chestnut. Well, to our shock and our surprise, these big trees we're finding, we began to do tests with them. So now if you can imagine looking at a visual, looking at a sterilized setting where you have a Tupperware pan or pot, if you will, and you have on the left American chestnut leaf, Then you have an Ozark chinquapin leaf that, you know, is like from the blighted stump sprouts. Then you have an Ozark chinquapin leaf from a large surviving tree. And then the fourth leaf you have to the right of it is going to be a Chinese chestnut leaf, if you're with me. Mm-hmm. So then use the same method. You inoculate a leaf using the same size plug on all four of them. And you use the most potent blight that you can. And, you know, we get fresh blight and we make sure that it's, you know, the most dangerous blight you can get. And so we're trying to test these as hard as we can. So after about 3 or 4 days, you begin to see very rapidly that the American chestnut leaf, the blight is spreading real quickly in it. Mm-hmm. Then you look at the Ozark chinquapin leaf, the lower resistant one that you find that's pretty typical of what you'll see on surviving trees. And, you know, like out of 600 trees, this is what you'll see. And so it's spreading not quite as fast, but still spreading. Look way over to your right to that fourth one over there, and you're going to see the Chinese, which it has less blight spread than any of them. Then you look at the third leaf, which is our large Ozark chinquapin surviving tree, you know, some of those quite large. And to our surprise, we found some of these are showing more resistance to the blight than the Chinese chestnut. Wow. And that's something we were surprised about. So in these tests, our trees that we have crossed, you know, these large surviving trees, they're showing as good a resistance or better resistance or a little bit less than the Chinese. And we've been seeing this in the field. And so now to see it confirmed in the lab is incredible, and to see it this fast. So we've done over 63, I think, inoculation tests on different Ozark chinquapins. And it's incredible. So that resistance is out there. And so we're waiting to hear more. We've got right now, we're doing a lab test at Notre Dame, and we're doing a different type of DNA testing. The other ones we've done so far have been nuclear DNA chloroplast tests. And those are really good because you can tell a lot from those. You can tell, okay, this is Castanea dentata, you know, the American chestnut. This is Castanea pomilla allegheny, or this is Ozark chinquapin, or this is Chinese chestnut, or this is a cross. You can tell quite a bit from it. So the molecular testing that we're doing today is a little bit different. Only about 5% of labs are doing this one. And to give you a perspective of how good this testing is, it'd be like, man, if you went to the doctor and you said, okay, I need to have a checkup. I need to know a little bit more about what's going on with me and my health and what I'm susceptible to. They're like, okay. So doctor does your blood pressure, does your heart rate, test your eyes, test your ears. And then you go to another doctor. He does the same things. And that's what like this molecular testing is like. And he says, okay, we're going to draw some blood. And he says, okay, Matt, well, we found out, like the other test did, you know, about your eyesight, your hearing, blood pressure. Sure. But we found out that your blood sugar is really good. And but we found out also you have a little bit of trace of lead in your blood. And we also found out your ancestry, Matt. Did you know that you're 12% Italian and they can tell you which part of Italy you came from? You're 9% Native American, and it happens to be Cherokee. And they can also tell you that you're 28% Scottish. So this test is so in-depth, it will give us information about if you have any foreign castanea your trees, which we've already checked to see if it's there. But it'll also show if there's any North American castanea mixed in it, too. So some of these species that we had checked, like trees from Alabama or trees from Oklahoma or Arkansas, it will show us if there's any maybe chestnut mixed in with it or if there's any foreign castanea, which is possible. But in the wild, it doesn't happen quite as readily as people may think. When the American chestnut blooms and when the Ozark chinquapin blooms, they're at different times. Ozark chinquapins typically bloom the peak in Missouri, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, East Texas. It's always right around June 1. Well, the peak bloom for American chestnut is roughly around the week of July 4th. So the peak blooms in the wild are different. You know, it could still happen, but the odds are real small of it. And then the Allegheny, it actually blooms. I've got friends of mine that work with them. From everything I can tell, it blooms even earlier than the Ozark chinquapin, the two blooms. It blooms about 2 weeks before the Ozark chinquapin does. So you got to remember these female flowers, there's not a long window of them. And so like on the end of a group of what will later be, you know, your nuts, the female flowers, you know, they go off like a pack of firecrackers. The ones on the very end will be ready to accept first pollen. And they have like about a 2 to 3 day window of time. And then it moves down it. So if there's not enough pollen available, you're only getting the very end one pollinated though. So going back, and here's another big find we did not know. So, you know, been a lot of interesting things. And I don't know if there's enough time here today to tell you all of it. But one thing the listeners may be interested to know is that under just good conditions, not excellent conditions, just good conditions, the tree, if it gets the taproot down, it can make pollen the second year and nuts the third. It can do that. Some Ozark chinquapins, though, it takes a little bit longer for them to start producing nuts. And, you know, you may see 5 years or 4 years. So there's a lot of variance we found. There, some trees produce a lot more nuts than others. Some of them produce a little bit larger nuts than others. And that goes back to it being an older species, is my hunch on it. You know, I can't prove it, but that's what I'm thinking, though. So we had one tree last year. We began to check to see how many nuts are these trees actually producing. And I thought, okay, we'll collect the nuts on the ground. And, you know, on my days off, I thought I'll go back and I'll collect nuts and we'll see what we're getting. So we had one tree that was planted in, let me get this straight. I think it was planted in 2011 because we produced that cross in 2010. So we planted the tree in 2011. And so that tree last year was 7 years old. It was 17 feet tall. And we collected 3,611 nuts off of that tree. And that sounds incredible, I know. And the tree is only 17 feet tall. Well, I put up trail game cameras around the tree. So we were collecting these nuts. There's a few on the ground. But I would see deer droppings, turkey droppings, and you could see where animals had been eating the nuts. And I thought, you know, these aren't all the nuts we're getting. So we'd shake the tree and collect more nuts off the ground. And we would even, you know, bend branches down and pull some off, cut some off. That's how we got our count. So then after, I guess about the first week or two, I thought, I'm going to look at these trail camera pictures. Every 20 seconds, I was getting a video and the cameras had been full and they would have like 8 megabytes on them. I had to go into 16 and 32 megabytes on them. And change the discriminator. There were so many mice and squirrels and chipmunks eating those nuts. And in addition to the deer, we would leave 41 minutes later, the deer would show up. And turkeys were showing up too. And raccoons were showing up at night. And so the 3,611 is only what we collected.
Wow.
So my guess is that there was probably close to 5,000 nuts on that 17-foot tall tree. We had another one not far from there, and it was a much larger tree. I planted it in 2010, and it was 26 feet tall last year, and we estimated easily 5,000 nuts. We only collected a little under 4,000 off of that tree. And again, you look at the videos on it, and I had to change the discriminator so it wouldn't go off with squirrel-sized animals and smaller, and we don't know the true answer. How many was actually on that tree, and it was loaded. I mean, it looked easily, visually, you'd think it'd have double of what that other tree had. I've never seen anything like this. And if you see the places these trees grow, you're standing on rock. I mean, it's just rubble rock, hard scramble ground that other trees struggle to grow on. And that's where this tree did the best. They do not like good soil. They do not like humus. They cannot stand water on their roots. They're kind of like a cherry tree. And this thing is so productive. So unlike a crop of corn and unlike the oaks or the hickories that depend on, you know, if you have a late frost, it'll get a lot of oak blooms, or a heavy spring rain will get them. And so the Ozark chinquapin, because it blooms in June 1, it misses the spring frost and it misses the heavy rains. So not only does it make a crop, but it makes an extremely large one. And I've noticed if the weather around June 1 is particularly drier, not much rain, you get even more nuts. Wow. So here's a tree that grows on the worst soil you could imagine. And it produces not just nuts that are good for you, but a lot of them. So it's like a miracle tree, and it is a keystone species. And wherever it occurred, you had a bumper crop of wildlife. And no wonder, you know, the people I've talked to in their 90s said, if you ever want to kill squirrels, all you had to do is find a chinquapin tree. And you got to remember back then when they were telling about this, there were almost no bears in this part of the country. Mm. Deer were almost non-existent. Turkeys were almost non-existent. And if you saw a bear back then, it's like seeing a unicorn. And so all they were knew by as far as a wildlife magnet was squirrels. And I'm seeing this. It's just absolutely incredible. And it's awesome.
Yeah, that is such a remarkable detective story, because not only did you have this almost biological extinction, a tree being wiped back to near extinction, you also had cultural extinction, which mirrored that, you know, from through the generations, right? And it's just as much as you guys are bringing this tree back from the brink, you're also bringing it back into the mindset of the people around it. You know, you're bringing it back for a new generation of people to enjoy and to sort of reinvent the lore that surrounded this tree, which is incredible, because everything that you had heard stories of is coming to fruition. I mean, you yourself are seeing the proof is in the pudding, as they say. And yes. To know that you are having such a significant role in this drama that's unfolded over a century or more is just, it's amazing.
Yeah, I couldn't say it better than what you did. You were right on the mark. And here's something else to think about. What makes this even more amazing is that, you know, most people drive down the road, and I think you and I talked about this, and they see trees on both sides of the road, and they think, oh, we've got plenty of trees. Well, we do, but some parts of the country, you take like Mississippi or Alabama or southern Arkansas, northern Louisiana, you see almost cornrows of loblolly pine trees. Mm. And there's a reason why the old timers, when they surveyed, called an area pine barren. It's because nothing else lived there.
Right.
And so we're kind of recreating a monoculture, if you will. There's several things going on that, had I not worked with the state parks and you with what you do, and I saw, you know, the one podcast you did, and you did an excellent job of, you know, making heroes of all these unsung plants that, you know, they may not be numerous, but they're so important to insects. And so here's what's going on today. We're losing species of trees. Right now today, the ash, all the varieties of ash are dying except for the blue ash. And some people may not know it. That's the only one that has true resistance to, you know, emerald ash borer. And with more travel and proliferation of trade, you're getting more and more diseases and insects and pathogens coming to this country. And we are losing plant diversity, not just trees, but all plants. Mm-hmm. So when you lose those diversity of plants, you lose the diversity of rare insects. And by the way, your Facebook where you showed rare orchids being pollinated at night, that is just spot on. I like that.
Yeah.
And so everybody can make a difference. It's not all lost. And, you know, if you think it is, it is. And it's amazing to me, I should say, the difference one person can make in this world. And it's there. If you think you can, or if you think you can't, guess what? You're right on both of those.
Yep.
And I was told by experts this was not possible. So right now today, we're losing blue ash trees in Illinois, in Indiana, in Michigan, in Ohio. They've gone in, they've actually cut down all of the host for emerald ash borers, and there's none there. So you also look at the beech trees. There's one state park we have here in Missouri that we had gigantic beech trees in. And before long, the beech borer disease will reach us. And they're losing 94% of all beech trees. And those things live to be 300 to 400 years old. And you stand on one of those, it's real humbling to know that this thing was growing 400 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, we were a country. You know, maybe some of them were old enough that even the time of when Columbus came to America, they were still growing.
Right.
And so there's another food loss. We've got another diversity. If I remember correctly, the butternut tree, another name is white walnut.
Yep.
That species that they said was on its way out and it was going extinct. And I found some of those in the park I work in. I've set a database up on it. But, you know, you lose those. The elms, you know, we lost American elms or red elm, whatever you want to call it. We keep losing these species of trees. Right now in the bottomlands here in Missouri, it's probably going on in Illinois too, Lithoptera cinnanoma, the ink rot disease, is killing white oaks in bottoms. And, you know, they're dying out. And, I mean, we just keep losing more and more of our diversity. So it goes on constantly. And when you lose these tree species, you're losing our wildlife that has evolved to depend on those trees. I'll tell you one thing really interesting. Along with this, there's invasives that are coming in. And last Thursday, I spent part of my day at the park eradicating invasive plants, and they're crowding out our native ones. So not only are native ones declining by disease and by land use, but then you've got native ones that are crowding them out. We actually had in our park a place where we had bush honeysuckle that took hold, and our priority was to get rid of it. And it spread to a place probably about, I'd say, 100 yards by 100 yards, if you will. And where that was growing at, I made a video of it, and you could wade through that, and you would, you know, you had bush honeysuckle over you and under you, and there were no native plants in there. Our native plants like spicebush, Indian cherry, let's see, gooseberry, sassafras, all those were gone. All the understory plants, dogwood, they were crowded out. Mm. There was no other plants growing there. And so we treated it and got rid of those. And the last thing I did was hand pulling little 2 and 3 inch tall bush honeysuckle. And now it's coming back. They think they emit some kind of chemical that reduces that. But if you let something like that take hold, you will lose species. And they did a study a few years ago to give you an idea of how bad this is. And there's a bird called a cedar waxwing. It has an orange tuft on its head, looking kind of like what a cardinal has, so mm-hmm. to speak. So cedar waxwings are one of our native birds. And they found out that where bush honeysuckle had taken hold, the cedar waxwings, they no longer had their native plants to feed on. So they're eating a lot of these red berries on the bush honeysuckle. In fact, they've consumed so many of them that that tuft was no longer the orange. It was turning red. Well, birds have a very broad spectrum of colors. You know, mm-hmm. they can distinguish them real easy. And guess what? If the male doesn't look the right color, they won't mate with them. They found that the what used to be the orange tuft is now red from eating all the invasive bush honeysuckle berries. And then you take spicebush, you got spicebush butterfly. The caterpillar depends on spicebush to survive. So if you lose it, you lose that butterfly. And it goes on and on. So that's what we're actually dealing with. But there's a lot that we can do. Grow native is a big one, and getting rid of the non-native plants. And, you know, it's just amazing what's out there. And if you remove their habitat and you remove their food source, guess what? They will be gone as well.
Yeah.
So to do this on the tree, you know, I mean, this is not a species we're losing. It's one that we're bringing back. And this tree was so important that, you know, talking about its loss, these old timers I'd talk to, they would talk about this tree like losing a good friend. Mm. I mean, like they literally lost a friend. It was that important. And when it disappeared, it came at a time, especially east of the Mississippi River, you know, the American chestnut. It was at a time during the Great Depression. So it was even worse then. So people were losing a food source. And I read one article in an old magazine, it may have been Field and Stream or Sports Field, I forget, from the 40s. And they predicted that when the chestnuts disappeared in the eastern U.S., half of all the wildlife would disappear with it.
Wow.
And so this tree is important. And it's kind of like, you know, I told you I'm a beekeeper, too. But we've got all the unsung heroes. I'm sure Illinois is like Missouri. Unofficially, we have over 500 species of native bees.
Mm-hmm.
And so the honeybee, though, is kind of like the one that drew all the attention to what's going on. Well, the American chestnut drew the attention for the trees. And so it's something that's important. And in my opinion, if saving this tree and restoring it back for future generations and wildlife to inherit is not a project worthy of our best efforts, then there are no projects worthy of best efforts, in my opinion.
That's a beautiful sentiment.
That's just me speaking, though. And that's why I've given up so much to do this. And well, I'll tell you what, man, I read emails and letters and it just strengthens my resolve. You know, they talk about their parents remembering the trees or their grandparents, and those people that remember them are becoming less and less every year. The stump sprouts that remain out in these forests, we're finding those are starting to die now too. That's been going on the last few years. And it's not from blight. We think what's happening is those tree roots are running out of energy and they're dying. And so a chinkapin, its lifespan is typical or similar to maybe a red oak, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a super long-lived tree. You know, they'll live over 100 years or more, but you know, it's something like that on their lifespan. So we're thinking that the stump sprouts out in the forest that we're finding are dying, and it's not from the blight, but they're just running out of energy. So some of those trees have been dead since the 1950s or 1940s. So that just hastens the work that we need to be doing. So the number of people that remember them is becoming less and less, and the stump sprouts are out there becoming less and less. And when you get a wildfire in a forest, it will burn up your old logs that are rot resistant. They're not fireproof. And so it will remove that proof. And then when you have fire, it also burns up those old stumps. And so there goes your proof that those trees are actually there. So this is something that, you know, that everybody can help and be a part of. By all means, I wish we had $1 million. We did. Problem solved a lot of things about doing this. But until then, we got to keep working with, you know, our spare time, and we still have to work on our homes and take our kids to ball games and do that sort of thing. Life goes on. But by all means, if somebody wanted to be a sponsor or make a donation, you know, man, we would do what we had to accommodate and make sure that they got all the credit for it. That's kind of where we're at right now. And it's kind of like we're sliding into second base on this, or imagine a rocket ship taking off and, you know, we're heading for the stratosphere. So we know which trees now have the best resistance to the blight. So now we're in a position now where that, you know, we need more boots on the ground and to be able to let more people get these seed and get them planted and start doing the recovery on a big scale. And this key thing that we found out this year is critical, knowing which trees have the best resistance to focus on.
Right.
And so we leap forward a decade easily in 5 days this year.
Wow.
So this is just amazing of what we found out. So now we're at a point where that, you know, if somebody's out hiking or out walking out in the woods, look, you know, no matter where you're at, this tree, like I said, they used to think that it had a smaller range just in the Ozarks. Now we know that's true. Remnant populations in East Texas we're working on right now. We have research test plots. We have some from Texas, northern Louisiana, southern Arkansas, northern Arkansas, Oklahoma. We work with the Cherokee Nation as well. Missouri, we find them in new places in Missouri, southeast Missouri, and then Alabama, Mississippi. And surprisingly, they were even in Virginia. Whoa. And we had that confirmed by a laboratory test, two of them. And I've got a guy, I've got a call that's got one there today from a remnant population. And they were in northwest Georgia. And now we found four counties in Alabama had remnant populations. And some of those were misidentified in herbarium samples. They thought they were the Allegheny chinkapins that just grew to a tree form, but they were Ozark chinkapins. They have chestnut looking leaves and, you know, the one nut per bird, but it's larger. And so there's a lot to be done.
Yeah.
So we're only able to do about 6 or 8% now. At one time, that was all you need to do, but it's grown so big now. But that 6 to 8% is some of the most important thing needs to be done. But just finding trees would be a full-time job for three people right now. But it's important to keep finding those new genetics and keep adding those to our gene pool, though.
Yeah.
That's important, and to save that gene pool before we completely lose it. The place where I saw that first tree at, there were stump sprouts everywhere, and there were logs everywhere. And I said, this is incredible. And he said, you know, I've been hunting up here for years and didn't find that tree. He said, I heard a turkey gobble, and I stopped, and I set up, you know, underneath that tree, and I was sitting there waiting for that turkey to come in. I was looking around. He said, I saw all these birds all around me. And I thought, oh, my gosh, these are chinkapin birds. And he thought to himself, well, where's the blighted stump sprouts at? He said, I looked around. I couldn't see them anywhere around me. Then I looked up and I thought, oh, my gosh, I'm leaning against my first ever Ozark chinquapin tree. And so the range of them is a lot larger. And somebody out turkey hunting, hiking, bird watching, they can help too.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, funding is a big thing we need. But if you join the Ozark Chinquapin Foundation, the membership's $30. You can join online and we will send you, we send 2 seeds, then we upped it to 3. Now we're sending 5 or more seeds. So good Lord willing, if we still get plenty of seed again this year, they come from our research test plots. And their crosses are the best of the best that we have. And so we want people to actually plant them out and get them growing. And, but you know, this work that we're doing is for people that want to grow these. We don't want anyone to try to commercialize them.
Right.
And try to, you know, get rich off of what we've done, you know, and we're constantly experimenting. We're an open-minded group and we're using field work and lab work to push this work along. But our members are a very, very important component. So we've got Ozark Chinquapin members. If I had enough time to talk to everybody, everybody would probably renew. But we've probably given out seed and have probably about roughly 1,000 members,
wow,
give or take, I'd say roughly. And so all of them are part of the recovery effort. They're planting seed on their own property. And we have about 15 research test plots scattered in Oklahoma and Missouri and Arkansas. Most of them are in Missouri. So this is something everybody can get on board with, though. If you have well-drained soil in the habitat, you can get these started, and they're good to eat. It's like a protein boost when you eat these things. It's absolutely incredible. And that's another one is the food market. You know, you talked about, you know, bringing something back, a culture of it. At one time, this is important food. Now, I've eaten Chinese chestnuts, and I gave some to one old-timer a few years ago, and he just spit it out. He said, I don't want anything to do with that. That was his words. And so the Chinese chestnut, or if you go to the store, like a grocery store, most of the stores, the chestnuts they have are the European chestnuts. They don't have quite the protein and carbohydrates, so they taste as sweet. They're a little bit larger. American chestnut, same way too. They still taste pretty good. But when you eat an Ozark chinquapin, they're smaller, and it is, it is like the difference between eating field corn and sweet corn. I'll put it that way to you, to try to relate it in an interpretive way where people would understand it. I mean, it is that big of a difference, and they have the most awesome after flavor. And at one of our meetings that we had, there's a guy that worked for 3 decades in France. He's the head chef, and he's now at Kansas City. So I sent him some of these nuts, and I never realized how particular this gentleman was. He was a perfectionist, and he wanted to know more about where these were collected from. Were they wild? Was it something cultivated? And he was very impressed by the flavor of them, and he made a chocolate treat for all of us and brought it down to our meeting, and none of them lasted. They all got eaten real quickly. So another thing is actually the food source we're bringing back. And everybody wants to eat healthy, and all of us are dealing with magnesium deficiencies. That was the big run in the news a few years ago. And part of that has to do with the farming. You know, we use phosphate fertilizer. I grew up in the Boot Hill. And so a lot of what we farm today is almost like hydroponics. They no longer rotate crops. Mm-hmm. And so phosphate fertilizers, not only do they kill the worms, they also kill or do away with your microbes in the soil. So without those microbes, you don't have an uptake of trace minerals. Huh. And right now where I'm at, you know, we've got dolomite limestone here, which is 38% magnesium. Well, unless you farm the old way where you don't use modern fertilizers, you don't get that uptake of those trace minerals. And items like magnesium, it doesn't take much for good human health, but it's very important. And so Ozark chinquapin, it lives on these real rocky, dry slopes that have dolomite limestone, you know, 38% magnesium. So its magnesium count is off the hook.
Wow.
It's one of the higher ones I've ever seen. So these real long taproots literally melt nutrients out of the rock. And so it's real high in trace minerals. And so it's just an awesome food source. Yeah. And so the only limiting factor of this tree is well-drained soil. You can't plant it down in bottom land, you know, where you might grow corn at. But in a way, it's kind of a good thing because it actually grows well where other plants struggle. So if you want to have a food plot for wildlife, you can do that in real good soil. And it doesn't take away land that in theory you would need for the Ozark chinquapin to grow.
Huh.
So it's a different concept having a tree food plot.
Yeah. Well, Steve, this is a remarkable story and a very inspirational work. And I mean that. I mean, this is proof is in the pudding of doing everything you can and making a huge difference. You know, people get overwhelmed by the environmental issues we face. People get dismal when it comes to habitat destruction and extinction. But here's proof that it only takes one person or even just a small group of people within a community to make a difference. So if people want to get inspired themselves, help out, how do they find out more about the Ozark Chinquapin Foundation?
Yeah. And while we're talking about credit, I mean, I'm just the organizer and I've burned up a lot of shoe leather and driven thousands of miles. But if I did not mention the people that helped make this different, all of our board members, you can look online and see their names. But I feel like before I tell you the other part, let me give a plug for them. So there were people that believed in what I was doing. And if it hadn't have been for their support, there's no way, man, I'd be sitting here today where we're at. And I know places like Pioneer Forest, the LAD Foundation here in Missouri, that's been left out of different news articles that I've done, and they didn't include it with National Geographic, but they believed in what I was doing, and their mission is similar to ours. And, you know, they're not just a timber company. They're green like we are, too, about trying to preserve our native forest and ecosystem. So, you know, hats off to them for making all this possible. You know, I didn't have the land, so they allowed us to use land and some of the rockiest, worst timberland they had. And it was the best land for those Ozark chinquapins. And without their support in the early years, a lot of this would not have been doable. Then, you know, the Missouri Conservation Heritage Foundation has given us small grants, probably, you know, I think around 18,000 or so, plus some of their own board members out of their own pocket over a period of years, you know, and then people, you know, that helped me with that, you know, and Department of Conservation, Missouri Department of Conservation, Arkansas Forestry, all of them are great. And a lot of individuals that stepped forward, and they are the true heroes on this. And I wouldn't have as many good friends, man, if I weren't doing this tree work. It is it's very inspiring to see people come forward and work on their days off and unselfishly sacrifice their time to try to save this tree. And I've gone on tree trips, making a big circle, driving over 1,000 miles, pollinating trees. And I'll have people waiting for me out in the middle of nowhere where you drive and drive and drive. And off in the distance, you'll see a glow, and it's from lanterns set up in an Ozark chinquapin tree on the ground. Maybe half a dozen trucks parked there waiting for me to show up, you know, so we could pollinate that tree. Wow. I mean, that kind of effort is inspiring. And you talk about being out on a limb to save a species. This has really been it.
Yeah.
So before I tell you where they can contact us at, I want that known. That's something without it, you know, it would not have happened, you know. And I see that in every one of those 1,000 people. You could do an article just like we're doing today on them. and I'm serious. And it's amazing the people that step forward, like on the website and on getting our 501c3. And some people that passed away are no longer here. And that's unfortunate. And so, you know, I'm doing this and all this and these letters and these stories just strengthens your resolve about how important this is. You know, we're all on a mission and, you know, that's our resolve to do this, you know. And if we don't have the money to do it, it'll take a whole lot longer. But you know what? We're going to do this and we've done it so far on just a shoestring budget. And so if we don't have the money to make it happen, to get it out to more people, yeah, it'll take a lot longer. But getting back to this, though, if somebody wants to join, you know, it's $30, and you can go online, ozarkchinquapin.com, and we've got an excellent website, and you can get on there. And if you found a tree, email me. My email address is real simple. It's just stevebostocf@gmail.com. And, you know, a lot of the trees we have to weed through, I'd say probably 80%. People think they have one. It's really not. It's either chinquapin oak or it's Chinese. But, you know, that's okay. You know, they're trying. Mm-hmm. And I found a lot of ones that weren't the real thing, too. But you can go to that website. You can join. It's $30. We start mailing out the seeds sometime around Christmas through January and February. It's not until then that I've determined which seed are the best. And I personally hand select all the seed that go out. And this year, Chris White and Sean Smith of Arkansas Forestry are going to be sending them out. I'm going to collect them and check them. And we put our seed in about three different places. You know, it's not like putting your eggs in one basket. And so seed for the Ozark chinquapin, to find those, it's extremely rare. Seed with resistance to the blight, this is like absolute gold. And if you had to put a price on each seed that's resistant, you could probably charge $300 a seed. Jeez. But we're not doing that. This is like playing football, and you want to put the football in the hands of somebody who can do something with it. And the seed are the members that want to join. And if somebody wants to join and be a sponsor, we'll talk to them. This is a new area we've never been in, but if they want to make a larger donation, if we have enough seed, we can work out a deal with them, and we may be able to give them 100 or more. Wow. Which is something we've never been able to do in the past because we did not have that many resistant ones. And you got to remember, now we know which ones are the best of the best. So, so that's kind of where we're at. So we're wanting to share this and take this to another level so that we can get more out there. So that's kind of where we're at right now. And it's a good thing. And all of us being involved in it, and this includes you too, it's something we can all be proud of. To make a difference, like I said, for wildlife, our children to inherit. So that's the website address. You can go on there and you can look about tree ID. There's all kinds of good stories on there. There's recollections, and we're always adding more stuff. We're updating things constantly. And that newest tree that we found, we're going to get it on there too, where people can see it. And again, the owner doesn't want us to tell where it's at. We don't give out any GPS coordinates. Sure. And if we take somebody to see where we have trees growing at, we kid them about blindfolding them, but there's probably been no more than a dozen people total up at some of those plots. And some of the more restricted ones, there may have only been two or three people up to them.
Wow.
And but that's what you have to do. So we're moving now to where that it's not as bad as it was. And so we can start sharing a little bit more information. But we're past the point of like danger for this tree. And now we're another stage of the game, and I welcome it. You know, it's like I said, we're sliding into second base right now. But it's taken the support of everybody to do it. So the people that see this podcast, you know, and I've looked at your Facebook account, and, you know, you're making a difference. And so so that's a good thing. So thank did you. That answer your question? That's a long answer.
Yeah. No, it's just so beautiful and inspiring. And it really is. It's so evident how passionate this work is for you. And it's so nice that you and everyone involved is putting in this monumental effort. So, Steve, thank you so much for inspiring us today.
Thank you too, man.
Yeah.
And you keep up the good word too.
I'll try.
Appreciate it. And I guess, are we done here then?
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I think we'll say good day and until next time.
We'll say this is the beginning.
Yeah. This will be, you're welcome back on anytime to keep us updated. So
check back with me a little bit later on. We've got another study coming out, and I'm sure we'll have some more good stuff there too, though. But we appreciate everybody's support, and thanks again, and have a good day, and God bless you.
Yeah, you as well. And I really appreciate it. So keep up the great work.
Yes, sir. Take care.
Cheers. Bye. All right. So there you have it. These are the issues facing this tree, and Steve has offered us up a lot of solutions to saving this tree. Please consider supporting the Ozark Chinquapin Foundation. As he mentioned multiple times, they operate on a shoestring budget, and most of this work is done on a volunteer basis. So every little bit helps, I mean that. If you want to be part of the recovery of this tree species, go give either your money, or if you live in that area, give them some of your time. As always, thank you so much for listening. If you would like to support these efforts with the In Defense of Plants podcast, consider becoming a patron over at patreon.com/indefenseofplants. In fact, we have another shout out, the latest producer on this podcast. Big shout out to Bobby. Thank you so much for becoming a patron at the producer credit level. That is our highest tier over at Patreon, but you can go check out all of the other kickbacks we have. It doesn't take much, and every little bit goes a long way.
We also have merch for sale, teespring.com/stores/indefensiveplants. I just put up a new design. If you're a plant nerd, it might be a shirt for you, and it's customizable. So go check out what we have over there. And of course, a portion of every purchase is being donated to the Rainforest Trust. So many great things on the horizon, including an adventure. If you're following us on Instagram, you saw I recently was in the Panhandle of Florida. It was an incredible experience. So many cool plants, so many of them endemic to that region. Just overall, great botanizing. And if you want to hear a really cool adventure that I had while I was down there, make sure you're checking back in over the next couple of weeks. But yeah, that's it. Thank you all for listening. Check the show notes for this episode as well as all the other episodes. That's where I put up links so that you can pursue more information on these subjects. But until next time, this is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios, everyone.